That is. Lazarus. Yes, Minerva? The published literature makes one option both certain and safe. This method can be used to create your twin sister, identical rather than fraternal, safe for sex. A host mother is indicated, with no forcing to maturity, since the brain would be allowed to develop normally. Would this meet your standards of newness and interest, to watch yourself grow up as a woman? Lazulai Long, you might name her, your female other self. Huh. Lazarus stopped. I said dryly, Grandfather, I think I've won our second bet. Something new? Something interesting?
Now, slow up. You can't do it. You don't know how, nor do I. And the director of this madhouse appears to have moral scruples about it.
We don't know that. Mere inference.
Not so mere. And I may have moral scruples. 'Twouldn't interest me unless I stuck around and watched her grow up, which might send me crazy either through trying to make her grow up just like me, what a fate for any girl, or by trying to keep her from growing up as ornery as I am, when that would be in her nature. Nor would I be justified either way. She would be a separate human being, not my slave. Besides that, I would be her sole parent, no mother. I've had one crack at trying to raise a daughter alone. It's not fair to the girl.
You're inventing objections, Lazarus. I'll give long odds that Ishtar would gladly be both host mother and foster mother, especially if you promised Ishtar a son of her own. Shall I ask her?
You keep your biscuit trap shut, son. Minerva, place that on pending. I won't be hurried into a major decision about another person, especially one who isn't, quite. Ira, remind me to tell you about the twins who were no relation to each other, but twins.
Preposterous. You're changing the subject.
So I am. Minerva, what else do you have, girl?
Lazarus, I have one program which involves low hazard and a probability approaching certainty of supplying one or more experiences completely new to you.
I'm listening.
Suspended animation.
What's new about that? We had that when I was a kid, hardly 200 years old. Used it in the New Frontiers. Didn't attract me then, doesn't now.
As a means of time travel, if you stipulate that in X number of years something truly new will develop, a certainty based on history, then your only problem is to select whatever span of years will, in your opinion, produce the degree of novelty you seek. 100 years, 1,000, 10,000, whatever you say. The rest involves nothing but minor design details.
Not so minor if I'm going to be asleep and unable to protect myself.
But you need not go into hibernation until you are satisfied with my design, Lazarus. 100 years is obviously no problem. 1,000 years is not much problem.
In years I would design an artificial planetoid, equipped with fail-safes to ensure that you would be revived automatically in case of emergency.
That would, take quite some designing, girl.
I feel confident of my capacity to do it, Lazarus, but you are free to criticize and reject any part of it. However, there is no point in my submitting preliminary designs until you give me the controlling parameter, namely the time span, which in your opinion will produce something new to you. Or do you wish my advice on that?
Hold your horses, dear. Let's assume that you've got me in liquid helium and in free fall and thoroughly protected against ionizing radiation.
No problem, Lazarus.
So I stipulated, dear. I'm not underrating you. But suppose some tiny little fail-safe fails null instead, and I go on snoozing through the centuries, and millennia without end. Not dead, but not revived either.
I can and will design to avoid that. But let me accept your stipulation. In such case, how would you be worse off than you would be if you used your termination option switch? What do you lose by trying this?
Well, that's obvious. If there is anything to this immortality talk, or any sort of afterlife, I'm not saying there is or isn't, but if there is, then when the roll is called up yonder, I won't be there. I'll be asleep, but not dead, somewhere off in space. I'll miss the last boat.
Grandfather, I said impatiently, quit trying to wiggle out. If you don't want it, just say no. But Minerva has certainly offered you a way to reach something new. If there is anything to your argument, which I don't admit, you will have achieved something really unique. The only human being out of many billions to fail to show up for muster on this hypothetical and highly unlikely judgment day. I wouldn't put it past you, you old scoundrel. You're slippery. He ignored my slur.
Why highly unlikely?
Because it is. I won't argue it.
Because you can argue it, he retorted.
There isn't any evidence for or against, so how can you assign even a loose probability either way? I was pointing out the desirability, if there happens to be anything to it, of playing it kosher. Minerva, held that under, pending, too. The idea has everything you claim for it, and I don't doubt your ability as a designer. But like testing a parachute, it's a one-way trip with no chance to change my mind after I jump. So, we'll look over all other ideas before falling back on that one, even if it takes years.
I will continue, Lazarus.
Thanks, Minerva. Lazarus looked thoughtful as he picked his teeth with a thumbnail. We were eating, but I have not mentioned breaks for refreshment, nor will I again. You may assume any food and rest breaks that make you feel comfortable. Like Scheherazade's tales, the senior's anecdotes were chopped up by many irrelevant interruptions. Lazarus.
Son? I was daydreaming. A far country, and the wench is dead. Sorry.
You could help Minerva in this search.
So? Seems unlikely. She's better equipped to conduct a needle-in-a-haystack search than I am. She impresses me.
Yes, but she needs data. There are these great gaps in what we know about you. If Minerva knew those 50-odd professions you followed, she might be able to cancel several thousand possibility pockets. For example, have you ever been a farmer?
Several times.
So, now that she knows that, she won't suggest anything relating to agriculture. While there may be sorts of farming you have never done, none would be novel enough to meet your, stringent requirements. Why not list the things you have done?
Doubt if I can remember them all.
That can't be helped, but listing what you do remember may call to mind others.
Let me think. One thing I always did every time I reached an inhabited planet was to study law. Not to practice, not usually, although for a number of years I was a very criminal lawyer, on San Andreas, that was. But to understand the ground rules. Hard to show a profit, or to conceal one, if you don't know how the game is played. It's much safer to break a law knowingly than to do so through ignorance. But that backfired once, and I wound up as High Justice of a planetary Supreme Court, just in time to save my bacon, and neck. Let me see. Farmer, and lawyer, and judge, and I told you I had practiced medicine. Skipper of many sorts of craft, mostly for exploration, but sometimes for cargo or migrant transport. And once an armed privateer with a crew of rogues you wouldn't take home to mother. School teacher. Lost that job when they caught me teaching the kids the raw truth. A capital offense anywhere in the galaxy. In the slave trade once, but from underneath. I was a slave.
I blinked at that. I can't imagine it.
Unfortunately, I didn't have to imagine it. Priest?
I had to interrupt again. Priest, Lazarus, you said, or implied, that you had no religious faith of any sort.
Did I? But faith is for the congregation, Ira. It handicaps a priest. Professor in a parlor house.
Excuse me again? Idiomatic usage?
Manager of a bordello. Although I did play the pianette a little and sang. Don't laugh. I had a pretty good singing voice then. This was on Mars. You've heard of Mars?
Next planet out from old home Terra. Sol 4.
Yes. Not a planet we'd bother with today, but this was before Andy Libby changed things. It was even before China destroyed Europe, but after America dropped out of the spacing business, which left me stranded. I left Earth after that meeting of 2012 and didn't go back for a spell, which saved me much unpleasantness. I shouldn't complain. If that meeting had gone the other way, No, I'm wrong. When a fruit is ripe, it will fall, and the United States was rotten ripe. Don't ever become a pessimist, Ira. A pessimist is correct oftener than an optimist. But an optimist has more fun. And neither can stop the march of events. But we were speaking of Mars and the job I had there. A fill-in job for coffee and cakes, but pleasant. I was also the bouncer. The girls were all nice girls, and it was a pleasure to throw out some slob who was misbehaving toward him. Throw him so hard he bounced. Then blacklist him so he couldn't come back. One or two like that every evening, and the word got around that happy days demanded gentlemanly behavior toward the ladies. No matter how big a spender a man was. Whoring is like military service, Ira. Okay in the upper brackets, not so good lower down. These girls were constantly getting offers to buy up their contracts and get married, and all of them did get married, I think. But they were making money so fast that they weren't anxious to grab the first offer. Mainly because when I took over, I put a stop to the fixed price the governor of the colony had set, and reinstated the law of supply and demand. There was no reason why those kids shouldn't charge every ruble the traffic would bear. Had trouble over that until the governor's provost for rest and culture got it through his thick head that slave wages won't work in a scarcity situation. Mars was unpleasant enough without trying to cheat those few who made it tolerable, or even delightful, when they were happy in their work. Whores performed the same function as priests, Ira, but far more thoroughly. Let me see. I've been wealthy many times and always lost it, usually through governments inflating the money or nationalizing or liberating something I owned. Put not your faith in princes, Ira. Since they don't produce, they always steal. I've been broke even oftener than I've been wealthy. Of the two, being broke is more interesting, as a man who doesn't know where his next meal is coming from is never bored. He may be angry or several other things, but not bored. His predicament sharpens his thoughts, spurs him into action, adds zest to his life, whether he knows it or not. Can trap him, of course. That's why food is the usual bait for traps. But that's the intriguing part about being broke. How to solve it without being trapped. A hungry man tends to lose his judgment. A man who has missed 7 meals is often ready to kill. Rarely a solution. Advertising copywriter. Actor. I was very broke that time. Acolyte. Construction engineer and several other sorts. And even more sorts of mechanic. For I've always believed that an intelligent man can turn his hand to anything, if he will take time to learn how it works. Not that I insisted on skilled work when my next meal was at stake. I've often pushed an idiot stick. Idiom? An old Gandhi dancer expression, son. A stick with a shovel blade on one end and an idiot on the other. I was never that for more than a few days, just long enough to sort out the local setup. Political manager. I was even a reform politician once, but only once. Reform politicians not only tend to be dishonest, but stupidly dishonest, whereas the business politician is honest. I don't see that, Lazarus. History seems to show. Use your head, Ira. I don't mean that a business politician won't steal. Stealing is his business. But all politicians are non-productive. The only commodity any politician has to offer is jawbone. His personal integrity, meaning if he gives his word, can you rely on it? A successful business politician knows this and guards his reputation for sticking by his commitments, because he wants to stay in business. Go on stealing, that is. Not only this week, but next year and years after that. So if he's smart enough to be successful at this very exacting trade, he can have the morals of a snapping turtle. But he performs in such a way as not to jeopardize the only thing he has to sell, his reputation for keeping promises. But a reform politician has no such lodestone. His devotion is to the welfare of all the people, an abstraction of very high order and therefore capable of endless definitions, if indeed it can be defined in meaningful terms. In consequence, your utterly sincere and incorruptible reform politician is capable of breaking his word 3 times before breakfast. Not from personal dishonesty, as he sincerely regrets the necessity and will tell you so, but from unswerving devotion to his ideal. All it takes to get him to break will tell you so, but from unswerving devotion to his ideal. All it takes to get him to break his word is for someone to get his ear and convince him that it is necessary for the greater good of all the people. Till geek. After he gets hardened to this, he's capable of cheating at solitaire. Fortunately, he rarely stays in office long, except during the decay and fall of a culture. I said, "I must take your word for it, Lazarus. Since I have spent most of my life on Secundus, I know little of politics, other than theoretically. You set it up that way." The senior fixed me with a stare of cold scorn. "I did no such thing." "But..." "Oh, hush. You're a politician yourself, a business politician, I hope. But that stunt of transporting your dissidents gives me doubts. Minerva, notebook, dear. My intention in deeding Secundus to the Foundation was to set up a cheap and simple government, a constitutional tyranny, one in which the government was forbidden to do most things, and the dear people, bless their black, flabby little hearts, were given no voice at all. I didn't have much hope for it. Man is a political animal, Ira. You can no more keep him from politicking than you can keep him from copulating, and probably shouldn't try. But I was young then, and hopeful. I hoped to keep politicking in the private sphere, keep it out of government. I thought the setup might last a century or so. I'm amazed that it has lasted as long as it has. Not good. This planet is overripe for revolution, and if Minerva doesn't find me something better to do, I might show up under another name, with my hair dyed and my nose bobbed, and start one. So be warned, Ira. I shrugged. You forget I'm migrating.
Oh, yes. Though the prospect of suppressing a revolution might change your mind. Or perhaps you would like to be my chief of staff, then displace me with a coup d'etat after the shooting is over and send me to the guillotine. That would be something new. I've never tended to lose my head over politics. Huh. Doesn't leave much for an encore, does it? A tisket, a tasket, a head, and a basket. It cannot reply to questions you ask it. Final curtain, no bows. But revolutions can be fun. Did I tell you how I worked my way through college? Operating a Gatling gun for $5 a day and loot. Footnote. The Gatling gun, Richard J. Gatling, 1818 to 1903, was obsolete by the time Lazarus Long was born. This allegation is barely possible if one stipulates that an obsolete weapon might be used in some small, out-of-the-way insurrection. Justin Foote, the 45th. Never got higher than corporal because each time I had enough money for another semester, I deserted. And being a mercenary, I was never tempted to become a dead hero. But adventure and change of scene are appealing to a young man, and I was very young. But dirt and missing meals and the whoosh of bullets past your ears stop being glamorous as you grow up. The next time I was in the military, not entirely my idea, I chose Navy instead, wet Navy, although I was Space Navy at later times and under other names. I've sold almost everything, except slaves, and worked as a mind reader in a traveling show, and was a king once, a much overrated profession, the hours are too long, and designed women's styles under a phony French name and accent, and with my hair long. Almost the only time I've worn long hair, Ira. Not only does long hair need a lot of time-wasting care, it gives your opponent something to grab in close combat and can obscure your view at a critical moment. Either one can be fatal. But I don't favor a billiard ball cut because a thick mat of hair, not so long as to fall over your eyes, can save you a nasty scalp wound. Lazarus appeared to stop to think. I don't see how I can list all the things I've done to support myself and my wives and kids, even if I could remember them. The longest I ever stuck to one job was about half a century. Very special circumstances. And the shortest was, after breakfast to just before lunch. And again, special circumstance. But no matter where or what, there are makers, takers, and fakers. I prefer the first category, but I haven't spurned the other two. Whenever I was a family man, usually, that is, I haven't let compunction stop me from keeping food on the table. I won't steal another child's food to feed my own, but there is always some way not to sickeningly fake to Gardner Veluda if a man isn't too picky, which I never was whenever I had family obligations. You can sell things which have no intrinsic value, such as stories or songs. I've worked every branch of the entertainment profession, including a time in the capital of Fatima, when I squatted in the marketplace with a brass bowl in front of me, telling a story longer than this one and waiting at cliffhangers for the clink of a coin. I was reduced to that because my ship had been confiscated and foreigners weren't permitted to work without a permit. A high squeeze on the theory that jobs should be reserved for local citizens, there being a depression. Telling stories without a fee wasn't classed as work, nor was it begging, which required a license, and cops let me alone as long as I volunteered the customary daily gift to the Police Benevolent Fund. It was either get by with some such dodge or be reduced to stealing, difficult in a culture in which one is not sophisticated in the local customs. Still, I would have risked it, save that I had a wife and three small children. That hobbled me, Ira. A family man should not take risks that a bachelor finds acceptable. So, I sat there till my tailbone wore through the cobblestones, recounting everything from Grimm's fairy tales to Shakespeare's plays, and not letting my wife spend money on anything but food until we saved enough to buy that work permit, plus the customary cumshaw. Then I clobbered him, Ira.
How, Lazarus?
Slowly but thoroughly. Those months in the marketplace had given me a degree of sophistication in the who, whom of that society, and what its sacred cows were. Then I stayed on for years. No choice. But first I was baptized into the local religion, gaining a more acceptable name in the process and memorizing the Quran. Not quite the same Quran I had known some centuries earlier, but it was worth the effort. I'll skip over how I got into the Tinker's Guild and got my first job repairing television receivers, had my pay doc to cover my contribution to the guild, that is, with a private arrangement to the Grand Master Tinker, not too expensive. This society was retarded in technology. Its customs didn't encourage progress, and they had slipped behind what they had fetched from Earth about 5 centuries earlier. That made me a wizard, Ira. And could have got me hanged had I not been careful to be a faithful and open-handed son of the church. So once I got into position for it, I peddled fresh electronics and stale astrology, using knowledge they didn't have for one and a free imagination for the other. Eventually I was chief stooge to the very official who had confiscated my ship and trade goods years earlier, and I was helping him get richer while getting rich myself. If he recognized me, he never said so. A beard changes my looks quite a lot. Unfortunately, he fell into disfavor, and I wound up with his job.
How did you work that, Lazarus? Without being caught, I mean.
Now, Ira. He was my benefactor. It said so in my contract, and I always addressed him as such. Allah's ways are mysterious. I cast a horoscope for him, warning him that his stars were in bad shape. And so they were. That system is one of the few I know of with 2 usable planets around the same star, both colonized and with trade between them. Artifacts and slaves.
Slaves, Lazarus?
Well, I am aware of such a practice on Supreme. I didn't think that vice was very common. Not economic. The old man closed his eyes, kept them closed so long I thought he had fallen asleep. He often did during the early days of these talks. Then he opened them and spoke very grimly. Ira, this vice is far more common than historians usually mention. Uneconomic? Yes. A slave society can't compete with a free one. But with a galaxy as wide as it is, there is usually no such competition. Slavery can and does exist many times and places, whenever the laws are rigged to permit it. I said that I would do almost anything to support my wives and kids. And I have. I've shoveled human excrement for a pittance, standing in it up to my knees, rather than let a child go hungry. But this I will not touch. Nor is it because
I was once a slave myself. I have always felt this way. Call it a belief, or dignify it as a deep moral conviction. Whatever it is, for me it is beyond argument. If the human animal has any value at all, he is too valuable to be property. If he has any inner dignity, he is much too proud to own other men. I don't give a damn how scrubbed and perfumed he may be. A slave owner is subhuman.
But this doesn't mean that I'll cut my throat when I run into it. Or I would not have lived through my first century. For there is another bad thing about slavery, Ira. It is impossible to free slaves. They have to free themselves.
Lazarus scowled.
You've got me preaching again, and about matters I can't possibly prove. Once I got my hands on my ship, I had it fumigated, and checked it over myself, and had it loaded with items I thought I could sell, and had food and water taken on for the human cargo it had been refitted for, and set the captain and crew on a week's leave. I notified the protector of servants, the state slave factor, that is, that we would load as soon as the skipper and purser were back. Then I took my family on a holiday inspection of the ship. Somehow the protector of servants was suspicious. He insisted on touring the ship with us. So we had to take him along when we took off from there, very suddenly, shortly after my family was aboard, right out of that system, and never went back. But before we put down on a civilized planet, me and my boys, two almost grown by then, removed any sign that she had ever been a slaver, even though it meant jettisoning stuff I could have sold.
What about the protector of servants? I asked.
Wasn't he some trouble to you? Wondered if you would notice that. I spaced the bastard. Alive. He went that-a-way. Eyes popped out and peeing blood. What did you expect me to do? Kiss him?
Counterpoint 3. Once they reached the privacy of a transport, Galahad said to Ishtar,
"Were you serious in your proposal to the senior, to have progeny by him?"
"How could I be joking? In the presence of two witnesses, one of them the chairman pro tem himself?"
"I don't see how you could be. But why, Ishtar?"
"Because I'm a sentimental atavist."
"Do you have to snap at me?"
She put an arm around his shoulders, took his hand with her free hand. "I'm sorry, dear. It has been a long day. And not much sleep last night, sweet as it was. I'm worried about several things, and the subject you brought up is not one I can be unemotional about." "I should not have asked. An invasion of privacy. I don't know what's got into me. Shall we wipe the matter, please?"
"Dear, dear. I do know what got into me. And that's part of why I'm so unprofessionally emotional. Let me put it this way. If you were female, wouldn't you jump at a chance to make such a proposal to him?"
"I'm not female."
"I know you're not. You're delightfully male. But try for a moment to be as logical as a female. Try."
"Males are not necessarily illogical. That's a female myth."
"Sorry. I must take a tranquilizer the minute we are home. Something I haven't needed in years."
"But do try to think about it as if you were female, please. 20 seconds?
"I don't need 20 seconds.
He lifted her hand, kissed it. "If I were female, I would jump at the chance, too. The best proved genetic pattern one can offer a child?
Of course."
"Not that at all."
He blinks.
"Perhaps I don't know what you mean by logic."
Does it matter, since we arrived at the same answer?"
The car swerved and stopped in a loading pocket. She stood up.
"So, let's wipe it. We're home, dear."
"You are, I'm not. I think."
"Men don't think."
"I think you need a night's rest, Ishtar."
"You sealed this one onto me. Now you'll have to undress me."
"So? Then you'll insist on feeding me, and you won't get that long night of sleep after all. Besides, you can peel it over your head, just the way I did for you at Deacon Tam."
She sighed.
Galahad, if I pick the right name for you, do I have to offer you a cohabitation contract merely because I might invite you to stay overnight again? It's likely that neither of us will get any sleep tonight. That's what I was saying. Overnight again? It's likely that neither of us will get any sleep tonight. That's what I was saying. Not quite. Because we may work all night, even if you choose to spend 3 minutes to our mutual pleasure. 3 minutes? I wasn't that hasty even the first time. Well, 5 minutes? And I offer 20 minutes, plus an apology? Men. 30 minutes, darling, and no apology. Accepted. He stood up. 5 of which you've wasted arguing about it. So come along, exasperating darling. He followed her out into her foyer. What's this about work all night? And tomorrow, too. I'll know when I check what's in my phone. If there's nothing, I'll have to call the chairman pro tem, much as I hate to. I've got to look over this rooftop cabin or whatever it is and see what arrangements can be made to take care of him there. Then both of us will move him. I can't delegate that. Then, Ishtar, are you going to agree to that? Non-sterile habitat? No emergency equipment and so forth? Darling, you are impressed by my rank. Mr. Weatherall is not. And the senior isn't even impressed by Mr. Weatherall's authority. The senior is the senior. I kept hoping that Mr. Chairman Pro Tem would find some way to wheedle him into postponing such a move. But he did not. So, now I have two choices. Do it his way or withdraw completely, as the director did, which I won't do, which leaves me no choice. So tonight I'll inspect his new quarters and see what can be done between now and tomorrow mid-morning. Even though it's hopeless to make such a place sterile, perhaps it can be made more nearly suitable before he sees it. And emergency equipment? Don't forget that, Ishtar. As if I would, stupid darling. Now, help me out of this damned thing. I mean, this pretty dress you designed for me, and which the senior clearly liked. Please? So stand still, and hold still, and shut up. Don't tickle! Oh, drat. There's the phone signal. Get it off me, dear. Hurry. Variations on a theme. 4. Love. Lazarus lounged in his hammock and scratched his chest. I'm a dryad, he said. That's not an easy question. At 17, I was certain I was in love. But it was merely excess hormones and self-delusion. It was most of 1,000 years later before I experienced the real thing. I didn't recognize the condition for years, as I had quit using that word. Ira Weatherall's pretty daughter looked puzzled. While Lazarus thought again that Ira had been wrong. Hamadryad was not pretty. She was so startling beautiful that she would have fetched top premium prices at auction on Fatima. With hard-eyed Iskandarian factors outbidding each other in the belief that she was a sound speculation. If the protector of the faith had not preempted her for himself. Hamadryad did not seem to know that her appearance was exceptional. But Ishtar did. The first 10 days that Ira's daughter had been part of Lazarus' family, so he thought of them, a good enough term as Ira, Hamadryad, Ishtar, and Galahad were all his descendants and now privileged to call him grandfather as long as they did not overdo it. Those first days, Ishtar had shown a childish tendency to try to place herself between Hamadryad and Lazarus, and also between Hamadryad and Galahad, even when this required being two places at once. Lazarus had watched this barnyard dance with amusement, and had wondered if Ishtar knew that she was doing it. Probably not, he decided. His rejuvenation supervisor was all duty and no sense of humor, and would have been shocked had she known that she had reverted to adolescence. But it did not last. It was impossible not to like Hamadryad, because she had remained quietly friendly no matter what. Lazarus wondered if it was a behavior pattern consciously developed to protect herself against her less endowed sisters, or was it simply her nature? He had not tried to find out. That Ishtar now tended to sit by Hamadryad, or even to make room between herself and Galahad for Hamadryad, and let her help in serving meals and such. Assistant housewife, de facto.
If I must wait 1,000 years to understand that word, Hamadryad replied, then I probably never will. Minerva says that it cannot be defined in Galacta, and even when I speak classic English, I find that I think in Galacta, which means that I do not really grasp English. Since the word love occurs so frequently in ancient English literature, I thought my failure to understand that word might be the block that keeps me from thinking in English.
Well, let's shift to Galacta and take a swing at it. In the first place, very little thinking was ever done in English. It is not a language suited to logical thought. Instead, it's an emotive lingo, beautifully adapted to concealing fallacies. A rationalizing language, not a rational one. But most people who spoke English had no more idea of the meaning of the word love than you have, even though they used it all the time. Lazarus added, Minerva, we're going to take another hack at the word love. Want to join in? If so, shift to your personal mode.
Thank you, Lazarus. Hello, Ira, Ishtar, Hamadryad, Galahad. The disembodied contralto voice answered. I am and have been in personal mode, and usually am, now that you have given me permission to use my judgment. You're looking well, Lazarus, younger every day.
I feel younger. But, dear, when you go to personal mode, you should tell us.
I'm sorry, Grandfather.
Don't sound so humble. Just say, howdy, I'm here. That's all. If you can manage to tell me or Ira just once to go to hell, it'll be good for you. Clean your circuits.
But I have no wish to say that to either of you.
That's what's wrong. If you hang around Dora, you'll learn to. Have you spoken to her today?
I'm speaking with Dora now, Lazarus. We're playing fairy chess in 5 dimensions. And she's teaching me songs you taught her. She teaches me a song, then I sing a tenor lead, while she harmonizes in soprano. We're doing this in real time because we're outing through the speakers in your control room and listening to ourselves. Right now we're singing the story of One Ball Riley. Would you care to hear us?
Lazarus flinched. Not that one.
We've practiced several others. Rangy Lil and The Ballad of Yukon Jake and Barnacle Bill. I sing the story on that one while Dora does soprano and bass. Or perhaps 4 Whores Came Down from Canada. That one is fun.
No, Minerva. I'm sorry, Ira, my computer is corrupting your computer.
Lazarus sighed.
I didn't plan it that way. I just wanted Minerva to babysit for me, since I've got the only retarded ship in this sector.
Lazarus, Minerva said reproachfully. I don't think it is correct to say that Dora is retarded. She's quite intelligent, I think. I do not understand why you say that she is corrupting me.
Ira had been lying on the grass, sunbathing with a kerchief over his eyes. He rolled to one elbow.
Nor I, Lazarus. That last one I'd like to hear. I recall where Canada was, north of the country you were born in.
Lazarus counted silently, then said,
Ira, I know I have prejudices ridiculous to a civilized modern man such as yourself. I can't help it. I'm canalized by early childhood, imprinted like a baby duckling. If you want to hear bawdy songs from a barbaric era, please listen to them in your apartments, not up here. Minerva, Dora doesn't understand those songs. To her, they are nursery rhymes.
Nor do I understand them, sir, other than theoretically. But they are jolly, and I have enjoyed being taught to sing.
Well, all right. Has Dora been behaving herself otherwise?
She's been a good girl, Grandfather Lazarus, and I think she is contented with my company. She pouted a little at not having her bedtime story last night, but I told her that you were very tired and already asleep, and told her a story myself.
But, Ishtar, did I miss a day?
Yes, sir.
Surgery? I didn't notice any new healed places.
The Master Chief Technician hesitated.
Grandfather, I will discuss procedures only if you insist. It does a client no good to be reminded of such things. I hope that you will not insist.
I do hope so, sir.
All right. All right. But next time you chop out a day, or a week, or whatever, warn me, so that I can leave a bedtime story on file with Minerva. No, that won't do. You don't want me to know. Okay, I'll keep stories on file with Minerva, and you warn her instead.
I will, Grandfather. It does help when the client cooperates, especially by paying as little attention to what we do as possible. Ishtar smiled briefly. The client we dread is another rejuvenator, worries and tries to run things.
Small wonder. I know, my dear. I have that horrid habit of trying to run things myself. The only way I can keep from it is by staying out of the control room. So when I get too nosy, tell me to shut up. But, how are we doing? How much longer do I have to go?
Ishtar answered hesitantly. Perhaps this is a time when I should tell you to shut up.
That's it. But firmer, dear. Get out of my control room, you custard-headed dolt, and stay out. Make him realize that if he doesn't jump, you'll toss him into the brig. Now, try it again.
Ishtar grinned widely.
Grandfather, you're an old fraud. So I've long suspected. I was hoping it didn't show. All right. The subject is love. Minerva, the Hammer Darling says you told her that it can't be defined in Galacta. Got anything to add to that?
Tentatively, yes, Lazarus. May I reserve my answer until the others speak?
Suit yourself. Galahad, you talk less and listen more than anybody else in the family. Want to try it?
Well, sir, I hadn't realized that there was any mystery about love until I heard Hamadryad ask about it. But I'm still learning English. By the naturalistic method, the way a child learns his milk language. No grammar, no syntax, no dictionary. Just listen and talk and read it. Acquire new words by context. By that method, I acquired a feeling that love means the shared ecstasy that can be attained through sex. Is that right?
Son, I hate to say this, because if you've been reading a lot of English, I see how you reach that opinion, but you are 100% wrong.
Ishtar looked startled. Galahad simply looked thoughtful.
Then I must go back and read some more.
Don't bother, Galahad. Most of those writers you've been reading misuse the word just that way. Shucks, I misused it for years myself. It's a prime example of the slipperiness of the English tongue. But whatever love is, it's not sex. I'm not running down sex. If there is a purpose in life more important than two people cooperating and making a baby, all the philosophers in history haven't been able to find it. And between babies, the practice runs keep up our zest in life and make tolerable the fact that raising a baby is one hell of a lot of work. But that's not love. Love is something that still goes on when you are not sexually excited. It being so stipulated, who wants to try it? Ira, how about you? You know English better than the others. You speak it almost as well as I do.
I speak it better than you do, Gramp. I speak it grammatically, which you do not.
Don't prattle me, boy. I'll quang you proper. Shakespeare and I never let grammar interfere with expressing ourselves. Why, he said to me once,
"Oh, stop it. He died 3 centuries before you were born."
He did, huh? They opened his grave once and found it empty. The fact is, he was a half-brother of Queen Elizabeth and dyed his hair to make the truth less obvious. The other fact is that they were closing in on him, so he switched. I've died that way several times. Ira, his will, left his second-best bed to his wife. Look up who got his best bed, and you'll begin to figure out what really happened. Do you want to try to define love?
No. You would change the rules again. All you have done so far is to divide the field of experience called love into the same categories Minerva divided it into when you asked her this same question weeks ago, namely, Eros and Agape. But you avoided using those technical words for the subfields, and by this sophistry you attempted to exclude the general term from one subfield and thereby claimed that the term to be defined was limited to the other subfield, which set it up for you to define love as identically equal to agape, but again without using that word. It won't work, Lazarus.
To use your own metaphor, I saw you palm that card.
Lazarus shook his head admiringly.
There are no flies on you, boy. I did a good job when I thought you up.
Today, when we have time to waste, let's have a go at solipsism. Come off it, Lazarus. You can't bulldoze me the way you did Galahad. The subcategories are still in to waste. Let's have a go at solipsism. Come off it, Lazarus. You can't bulldoze me the way you did Galahad. The subcategories are still Eros and Agape. Agape is rare. Eros is so common that it is almost inevitable that Galahad acquired the feeling that Eros is the total meaning for the word of love. Now, you have unfairly confused him, since he assumes, incorrectly, that you are a reliable authority with respect to the English language.
Lazarus chuckled.
Hiram, my boy, when I was a kid, they sold that stuff by the wagon load to grow alfalfa. Those technical words were thought up by armchair experts of the same sort as theologians, which gives them the same standing as sex manuals written by celibate priests. Son, I avoided those fancy categories because they are useless, incorrect, and misleading. There can be sex without love, and love without sex, and situations so intermixed that nobody can sort out which is which. But love can be defined, an exact definition that does not resort to the word sex, or to question begging by exclusion through the use of such words as eros and agape.
So define it, said Ira. I promise not to laugh.
Not yet. The trouble with defining in words anything as basic as love is that the definition can't be understood by anyone who has not experienced it. It's like the ancient dilemma of explaining a rainbow to a person blind from birth. Yes, Ishtar, I know you can fit such a person with cloned eyes today, but that dilemma was inescapable in my youth. In those days, one could teach such an unfortunate all the physical theory of the electromagnetic spectrum, tell him precisely what frequencies the human eye could pick up, define colors to him in terms of those frequencies, explain exactly how the mechanisms of refraction and reflection produce a rainbow image and what its shape is and how the frequencies are distributed until he knew all about rainbows in the scientific sense. But you still couldn't make him feel the breathless wonder that the sight of a rainbow inspires in a man.
Minerva is better off than that man because she can see.
Minerva, dear, do you ever look at rainbows?
Whenever possible, Lazarus. Whenever one of my sensor extensionals can see one. Fascinating.
That's it. Minerva can see a rainbow. A blind man can't. Electromagnetic theory is irrelevant to the experience.
Lazarus, Minerva added, it may be that I can see a rainbow better than a flesh and blood can. Rainbow better than a My visual range is 3 octaves, 1,512,000 angstroms. Lazarus whistled.
Whereas I chop off just short of 1 octave. Tell me, girl, do you see, chords in those colors?
Oh, certainly.
Don't try to explain to me those other colors. I'll have to go on being half blind.
Lazarus added,
puts me in mind of a blind man I knew on Mars, Ira, when I was managing that, recreation center. Gramp.
The chairman pro tem interrupted in a tired voice. Don't treat us as children. Surely you're the oldest man alive. But the youngest person here, that offspring of mine sitting there making cow eyes at you, is as old as Gramp Johnson was when you last saw him. Hema Dryad will be 80 her next birthday. Hem, my darling, how many paramours have you had?
Goodness, Ira, who counts?
Ever taken money for it?
None of your business, father. Or were you about to offer me some?
Don't be flip, dear. I'm still your father. Lazarus, do you think you can shock Hamadryad by plain talk? Prostitution isn't big business here. There are too many amateurs as willing as she is. Nevertheless, the few bordellos we have in New Rome are members of the Chamber of Commerce. But you should try one of our better holiday houses, say, the Elysium, after you are fully rejuvenated.
Good idea, agreed Galahad. To celebrate, as soon as Ishtar gives you your final physical check. As my guest, grandfather, I'd be honored.
The Elysium has everything, from massage and hypnotic conditioning to the best gourmet food and best shows. Or name it, and they'll supply it. Wait a moment, protested Hamadryad. Don't be a selfish arschfaddle. Galahad, we'll make it a foursome celebration. Ishtar? Certainly, dear. Fun. Or a sixum with a companion for Ira, father? I could be tempted, dear, for Lazarus' birthday party, although you know I usually avoid public places. How many rejuvenations, Lazarus? That's how we count this sort of birthday party. Don't be nosy, bub. As your daughter says, who counts? Wouldn't mind a birthday cake, such as I used to have as a child, but just one candle in the middle is enough. A phallic symbol, agreed Galahad. An ancient fertility sign, appropriate for a rejuvenation. And its flame is an equally ancient symbol of life. It should be a working candle, not a fake, if we can find one. Ishtar looked happy. Of course. There must be a candle maker somewhere. If not, I'll learn how and make it myself. I'll design it, too. Semi-realistic, but somewhat stylized. Although I could make it true portraiture, grandfather. I'm a fair amateur sculptor. I learned it when I studied cosmetic surgery.
Wait a minute, Lazarus protested. All I want is a plain wax candle. Then blow it out and make a wish.
Thank you, Ishtar, but don't bother. And thanks, Galahad, but I'll pick up the tab, although it may be a family party right here, where Ira won't feel like a duck in a shooting gallery. Look, kids, I've seen every possible type of joy house and pleasure dome. Happiness is in the heart, not in that stuff. Lazarus, can't you see that the kids want to treat you to a fancy party? They like you, though prime cause alone knows why.
Well, but there might be no tab.
I think I recall something from that list appended to your will. Minerva, who owns the Elysium?
It is a daughter corporation of Service Enterprises of New Rome Limited, which in turn is owned by Sheffield Libby Associates. In short, Lazarus owns it.
Be damned. Who invested my money in that? Andy Libby, bless his sweet shy soul, would be spinning in his grave. If I hadn't placed him spinning in orbit around the last planet we discovered together, where he was killed.
Lazarus, that's not in your memoirs.
Ira, I keep telling you lots of things not in my memoirs. Poor little guy got to thinking one of his deep thoughts and didn't stay alert. I put him in orbit because I promised him when he was dying to take him back to his native Ozarks. Tried to, about 100 years later, but couldn't find him. Beacon dead, I suppose. All right, kids. We'll have a party at my happy house, and you can sample anything the place has to offer.
Where were we? Ira, you were about to define love.
No, you were about to tell us about a blind man on Mars when you were managing that whorehouse.
Ira, you're as crude as Gramp Johnson was. This guy, Noisy, don't recall his right name if he had one, Noisy was one of those people like yourself who just will work, regardless. A blind man could get by in those days quite well by begging, and nobody thought the less of him, since there was no way then to restore man's sight. But Noisy wasn't content to live off other people. He worked at what he could do. Played a squeeze box and sang. That was an instrument operated by bellows which forced air over reeds as you touched keys on it. Quite pretty music. They were popular until electronics pushed most mechanical music makers off the market. Noisy showed up one night, skinned out of his pressure suit at the locked dressing room, and was playing and singing before I knew he was inside. My policy was trade, treat, or travel, except that the house might buy a beer for an old customer who temporarily wasn't holding. But Noisy was not a customer. He was a bum. Looked and smelled like a bum, and I was about to give him the bum's rush. Then I saw this rag around his eyes and skidded to a stop. Nobody throws out a blind man. Nobody makes any trouble for him. I kept an eye on him, but left him alone. He didn't even sit down, just played his broken-down stomach Steinway and sang. Neither very well. And I laid off the pianette not to interrupt him. One of the girls started passing the hat for him. When he reached my table, I invited him to sit and bought him a beer. And regretted it. He was pretty whiff.
He thanked me and told me about himself. Lies, mostly.
Like yours, Gramp?
Thanks, Sarah. Said he had been chief engineer in one of the big Harriman liners until his accident. Maybe he'd been a spaceman. I never caught him out in the lingo. Not that I tried. If a blind man wanted to claim he was the rightful heir to the Holy Roman Empire, I would go along with the gag. Anybody would. Perhaps he was some sort of space-going mechanic. Ship-fitter or something. More likely he was a transported miner who had been careless using power. When I checked the place at closing time, I found him sleeping in the kitchen. Couldn't have that. We ran a sanitary mess. So I led him to a vacant room and put him to bed. Intended to give him breakfast and ease him gently on his way. I wasn't running a flophouse. A lot I had to say about it. I saw him at breakfast all right, but I hardly recognized him. A couple other girls had given him a bath, trimmed his hair, and shaved him, and had dressed him in clean clothes. Mine! And had thrown away the dirty rag he had worn over his ruined eyes, and had replaced it with a clean white bandage. Kinfolk, I do not fight the weather. The girls were free to keep pets. I knew what fetched the customers, and it wasn't my peonet plan. If that pet stood on two legs and ate more than I did, I still did not argue. Hormone Hall was Noisy's home as long as the girls wanted to keep him. But it took me a while to realize that Noisy was not just a parasite enjoying free room and board, and probably our stock and trade as well, while siphoning off cash from our customers. No, he was pulling his weight in the boat. My books at the end of the first month he was with us showed the gross profit up and the net way up.
How did you account for that, Lazarus, inasmuch as he was competing for your customer's cash?
Ira, must I do all your thinking for you? No, Minerva does most of it. But it is possible that you have never thought about the economics of that sort of joint. There are three sources of gross. The bar, the kitchen, and the girls themselves. No drugs. Drugs spoil the three main sources. If a customer was on drugs and showed it or even broke out a stick of kish, I eased him out quickly and sent him down the line to the Chinaman's. The kitchen was to supply meals to the girls, who were assessed room and board on a break-even or lose-a-little basis. But it also served food all night to anyone who ordered it, and showed a net since we had its overhead covered anyhow to board the girls. The bar also showed a net after I fired one barkeep with three hands. The girls kept their gross, all the traffic would bear, but they paid the house a flat fee for each cupie. Or a triple fee if she kept a customer all night. She could cheat a little, and I would shut eye. But if she cheated too much or too often, or John complained that he was rolled, I had a talk with her. Never any real trouble. They were ladies. And besides, I had means to check on them quietly, as well as eyes in the back of my head. The beef's about rolling were the stickiest. But I remember only one that was the girl's fault rather than the John's. I simply terminated her contract, let her go. In the usual beef, the slob was not rolled. He simply had a change of heart after he had counted too much money into her greedy little hands and she had delivered what he had ordered. Then he tried to roll her to get it back. But I could smell that sort of slob and would be listening via a mic. Then would bust in as trouble started. That sort of jerk I would toss so hard he bounced twice.
Grandfather, weren't some of them pretty big for that?
Not really, Galahad. Size doesn't figure much in a fight, although I was always armed against real trouble. But if I have to take a man, I have no compunction slowing me down about how to take him. If you kick a man in the crotch with no warning, it'll quiet him down long enough to throw him out. Don't flinch, Hamadir. Your father guaranteed that you could not be shocked. But I was talking about Noisy and how he made us money while making some himself. In this sort of frontier joint, the usual customer comes in, buys a drink while he looks over the girls, picks one by buying her a drink, goes to her room, then leaves. Elapsed time, 30 minutes. Net to the house, minimum. Pre-Noisy, that is. After Noisy arrived, it went more like this. Buy a drink, as before. Maybe buy the girl a second drink, rather than interrupt the blind man's song. Take the girl to her room. When he comes back, Noisy is singing Frankie and Johnny or When the Pusher Met My Cousin, and smiles and throws a verse at him. and the customer sits down and listens to all of it, and asks Noisy if he knows Dark Eyes. Sure, Noisy knows it. But instead of admitting it, he asks the John to give him the words and hum it, and he'll see what he can do with it. If the customer has Valuta, he's still there hours later, having had supper and bought supper for one of the girls and tipped Noisy rather lavishly, and is ready for an encore with a girl or another girl. If he's got the money, he stays all night, splitting his cash between the girls and Noisy and the bar in the kitchen. If he spends himself broke and has...